Hey everyone, welcome to the April episode of our Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. Season 2 rolls on with my co-host Kaylee Bynes. I'm Ben Wilson, hanging out. We are getting ready to welcome in our first non-VF guest of the year. We had a great conversation with Kaylin Young in our first episode of this second season. If you missed that, check out all of our archive podcasts available on our Apple and Spotify channels. But today, Kaylee, we are talking with Dr. Christian Panyu, who is north of the border in Toronto, doing a lot of incredible work right now. He was actually, speaking of Kaylin Young, our last guest, he was just featured somewhat alongside her as he was a big part of the recently conducted EGPA registry that was done kind of in coordination with the VPPRN. So we're going to talk to him about that. A lot of cool research efforts going on. I'm mostly just proud of myself because I pronounced his last name correctly. He is originally from France, now working in Canada. And yeah, it's now your turn to try saying his last name correctly. I know you can do it, Kaylee. I believe you.
Oh man, maybe I'll just avoid it. But okay. Yes, yeah, so Dr. Panyu knows that I can't speak French, so we're okay with that. But he does have a background in internal medicine and clinical immunology. And as he mentioned, he went from France then to Canada. He's also collaborated with some US researchers, and near and dear to my heart, he has an MPH, so public health, and also actually a master's of science as well. So many degrees, but we're excited to hear from him, especially his work, as you mentioned, with the EGPA registry and also CANVAS, the Canadian Network for Research on Vascular Disease.
Yeah, and it's something that is sort of mirrors what we are seeing going on right now with the ACR, American College of Rheumatology, and their upcoming guidelines. We're going to talk to them about those and kind of the subtleties and differences between the two. So a really interesting conversation. Hope you can, hope you enjoy it. And we will be joined by him right now after this short break. And let's welcome in our guests now to the latest episode of the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. We are so pleased to be joined from north of the border by Dr. Christian Panyu, hanging out with us in this April edition of the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. This has been a guest a long time in the making, Kaylee. Great to have Dr. Panyu on now with everything crazy going on in the world. So Dr. Panyu, let's start with this. I know you're a busy man working in Toronto right now at Sinai Hospital there. What's the latest? What are you doing as we speak there?
Oh, I'm hello, Ben and Kaylee. First, hello, everyone. Well, I'm in my office. You know, we still do some in-person clinics. And so every so often I come to the office and see some patients or work on computer things, on research projects. It's very sunny in Toronto today. It's still minus 10, but it's very sunny.
Oh boy. Yeah. Well, as someone living in, I'm here in Las Vegas, Nevada, so not to rub it in, but a little bit warmer than the minus 10. And you mentioned research, which is a big reason why we're bringing you on today. I know, and for me, having EGPA, I know our last guest we just had on, Kaylin Young with the VPPRN, we talked to her about a lot of the recent research efforts through that branch of the VF, and I know you were involved with that as well through the EGPA registry, kind of a subset of a lot of the different types of research that the VPPRN has been looking at developing here over the past year or so. So take us first through the EGPA registry and some of your takeaways from that, because I know every amount of research on different diseases is different from the standpoint of what you can take away and what you can learn. So what was your overall takeaway from the registry as a whole as it related to EGPA and what were some of the things that stood out to you throughout that process?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. As you may know, I've been quite involved in research on EGPA. It started now more than 20 years ago when I was in France, when I worked with a French group on registry, including on EGPA. And since I moved in Canada in 2010, I've been further involved with the Vasculitis Clinical Research Consortium, the VCRC, and thereafter the VPPRN, to try to enhance or implement larger programs on vasculitis such as EGPA, which were not as much studied as GPA, granulomatosis with polyangiitis or microscopic polyangiitis. And so I'm happy to see that over the past 5 years, let's say, research on EGPA has really tremendously increased And that's why also we wanted to have this enhanced, that's how we call that, registry on EGPA. It started in 2006 with the VCRC in North America with Peter Merkel. And we just recently, with some of my residents here, analyzed all the data of more than 250 patients that have been entered in this registry since 2006 and 2019. But we said, hey, things have progressed and changed over the past decades. There are new treatments. We know better about the disease. So we needed, and we identified that we needed to record a few things a little bit differently. I would say a little bit better for some of those. So we will be able to study in more depth some aspect of that disease, study better the efficacy of the treatments with this new registry. So it's an online registry that we are conducting with the VCRC all across North America. And patients with EGPA, a diagnosis of EGPA, followed in one of the VCRC centers. So there are more than 15 centers all across North America, including Toronto in Canada, as well as Hamilton in Canada. But there are multiple other centers in the States, as you know. And so doctors are entering the data. When we see the patients, we see the patients every 3 months, but we do that study every year, and we enter the clinical data, how patients have been doing, which treatment they're taking, is it working or not working? And with all of that, we expect, we hope that we're going to be able to better describe the disease, define the characteristics of the disease, identify predictors of good response to treatment, and also, of course, identify the best therapeutic approaches for this condition. And at the same time, in parallel, we have what is called a VPPRN registry. That's a different approach. This one is really led by the patients themselves. And I know you discussed about the VPPRN registry with Callen Young recently. It's really here. Patients all across Canada, they don't have to be followed in any of the VCRC centers. They can participate in that online registry by just logging in online to the VPPRN website. And they will also be asked about information, clinical information regarding their disease, the treatment, how they've been doing. And that's going to also help us and provide some information on the disease, but with a different aspect, the patient aspect. And so these are two things that can really help nurture and advance knowledge on this EGPA disease. As I said, it was an understudied ANCA-associated vasculitis condition for the past 20 years, and there has been a big change and enthusiasm for that condition over the past 5 to 10 years. And that's also because there are some new treatments available.
That's really wonderful. And we're also excited for Ben in particular, because he has EGPA and I have GPA, as our listeners know. So, you know, we finally get to talk.
We're not
about
giving
Ben
up
thing.
On GPA.
Oh, good.
Well. We're doing a lot of study, more study on EGPA, but we're still working a lot on GPA.
I'm glad to hear it. And something that we've talked a little bit about, as you mentioned with Kaylin, but just patient recruitment that I know that can really be a challenge for research. How has that gone for the EGPA registry, you know, for both the registry and then also for the VPPRN side of things? Have you found it's fairly easy to keep up with patients, or it's kind of a struggle?
Well, it's the patients here in the clinic, we follow something like 150 patients with EGPA in Toronto, and I would say 90 of them are part of this registry. So most of the patients are agreeable to be part of studies, especially this one, because it's what we call an observational study. Patients don't have to take new experimental drug or be the guinea pig for anything. It's just we enter the data. But they still sometimes have to give us some blood so we can study the genes, we can study some cytokines, some proteins of inflammations and such. And that's once a year. And patients have to come and see us once a year at least to be part of that study. So that's why not all the patients want to be part of that. And also because, as I mentioned, in Canada, we have two centers, meaning, and you know, Canada is a big country, and it's the same thing in the States. So for patients who live remotely, to travel downtown and see us once a year can even be a struggle. And that's maybe one of the good things with this current pandemic is that we developed more and more virtual care medicine, and which allowed us to in fact enroll and reach out to more patients who are living remotely and far from our center. Because that's one of the main problem, I would say, with the medical VCRC registry is that the patients have to be seen in one of the VCRC centers. There are more than 15 across North America, but there are, of course, way more cities and places where the patients live. And that's the access to one of these VCRC centers that can be a main limiting factor. But otherwise, the registry has been doing very well, enrolling a lot of patients. But remember, EGPA is a rare disease. That's something we see approximately 2 new cases per million and per year in North America. So that's a limited number of patients. But these are usually very motivated patients, very kind patients, and they are, for most of those, very happy to help us increase knowledge on the disease.
Hear that, Ben? You're kind and knowledgeable.
I'll take that as a compliment. You're Dr. Pan, you're directly telling me I'm a kind individual. So, thank you. Appreciate it. Well, and as someone too, and I can relate to this because my physician is also across, at least for me, across state lines, and it's something that the pandemic definitely impacted, that being unable to, you know, when you have a physician you see once, and it's very similar for me, you see a physician once a year and you have to fly there. So the pandemic has changed things, and the telehealth certainly has made things easier. I don't think that's really that's probably a big similarity between the patients you've seen in Canada and here in the States. So there's really only a couple main experts as far as the field on that. Was it surprising to you how quickly things were able to transition into that? I know telehealth, something we talked a lot with our researchers about, especially last summer when we were in the real heat of the pandemic, and that was just the technological side of it, and development was such a big aspect of medical care overall, and also along with research being able to conduct it virtually. How, from that standpoint, how did things impact your research in that way, and was it were you surprised maybe at how quickly you were able to transition into something that effective?
Yeah, that's been a challenging time, and there have been multiple phases in the transition. I think the first few months of this lockdown, I would say a year ago now, it was not that easy to transition so fast. It was a kind of an abrupt curve, but it's true that with the technology and the software, there are several ones, then gradually it went better and better. And now, I would say a month ago, 90% of my clinical practice for the outpatients were done through telemedicine. But that said, it's a nice tool, but we are still eagerly looking forward the ability, the allowance, the option to see again people in person. I think there's still a link, that a relationship, some empathy that is way better when it's in person. But it's going to be, it's great, it was helpful, and I think now the system, the telemedicine network is way better. So that's going to be helpful for the patients who live remotely, but I'm still eagerly looking forward going back to normal time.
Definitely. I think we're all in that same boat. I think when we started recording COVID-19 themed podcasts, we thought it might be for a month or two. And here we are a year later, still talking about, you know, how we're dealing with this as the vasculitis community. And kind of to transition a little bit, speaking of vasculitis community, I'm always interested in how people really become passionate about vasculitis. As you mentioned, it's this very rare disease. It's not something that, you know, even my friends who are doctors or are in medical school know that much about. So can you just walk us through a little bit about how you developed an interest in vasculitis? I know you had the fellowship at the VCRC, but just kind of how your path shaped in this direction.
I think, Katie, you said something that's the word passionated about. And that's something weird about vasculitis indeed. People who go into this research field are most of them, all of them, passionate, and it comes from an encounter that created that passion. And for me, it's true that I started to work on vasculitis in 2000 in France. So that was with the French Vasculitis Study Group and Loïc Guilvin, who's the head of this French group. And that's how I developed that interest for vasculitis, which has become a passion. If you look at my CV, I would say 99% of my work over the past 20 years has been around vasculitis. I still do a little bit of internal medicine with the inpatients, seeing other stuff, pneumonia, the regular things, cardiac infarct, and so on. But otherwise, all my life is around the vasculitis. And when you discuss with other vasculitis experts, we often have the kind of the same profile, being passionate, having fallen into the pot when we were younger and staying there. So I worked in France with the French group until 2010. Then indeed, I decided to have not exactly a postdoc, but kind of a experience abroad in another center, and that's what brought me in North America to work in more collaboration with the VCRC, Peter Merkel, and the North American Network for 2 years initially. And I loved it so much here, and I created the Canadian Vasculitis Network, gathering with other colleagues from other centers in Canada. So after 2 years, having done all of that, I said, well, it's why don't I stay here and continue to work here, keeping my collaboration and relations with the French group. I still have some research projects ongoing with my colleagues over there. And that's how we try to help develop programs to improve somehow the management, maybe the outcomes of patients with these rare conditions. You say they are rare. That's true. Each of them is rare, but there are more than 26 different type of vasculitis. So all together, it really can keep you extremely, extremely busy. And because of the clinical care, because of the research, and as I mentioned, there are a few diseases that have been to date still understudied, including CNS vasculitis, for example, or cutaneous vasculitis. And these are disorders that we are now trying to focus on a little bit more with the VCRC and some other groups, as we did before. Before was everything for PAN and everything for GPA and then EGPA. And that's great. But as we move on to another disease, we need to develop more research projects on some other less studied conditions.
Right, and even we talked about this last year with relapsing polychondritis with Dr. Grayson when we had him on, how new of, and it's just amazing to exactly. Even in the midst of a pandemic, the research never stops and new discoveries mm-hmm. and new specifications on these vasculitis, they continue. And I know one of the other big projects, this has kind of been a more of a general thing, at least here in the States, has been with the American College of Rheumatology, and they embarked on this massive year plus long project trying to release their new overall guidelines on all different sorts of vasculitis, including the different AAV types. And I know it's a similar parallel to what you've been working on. Kaylee was just mentioning the CANVASC, which you started, and it's certainly developed over the past decade. And I know to your point that you talked about earlier with EGPA and learning so many new things over the past 4 or 5 years with that, I'm sure that's had a big impact as well. So kind of comparing what you found, and I know the ACR things, we sort of felt in the dark for so long, we kept waiting to hear all of the findings about their new research. So we'll start with your own research through the CANVASC before kind of comparing it, before I'll compare it to ACR. What sort of things did you find, at least here recently, let's just say within the past calendar, past 12 months or so, that were new and that were maybe updated things from what the previously, commonly considered structures were towards how to treat different vasculitis?
Well, first, regarding recommendation, as you mentioned, there will be the ACR guidelines, which are really United States guidelines. You have the CANVAS, the Canadian guidelines, you have the French guidelines, you have the German guidelines, you have the UK guidelines, the Japanese guidelines, the Australian guidelines. I think what is important in the development of guidelines is really to gather people, to gather clinical physician with some expertise in vasculitis in a specific environment. So for us, it was in Canada, because the healthcare system in Canada is not exactly the same in the US as in France and so on. So there are some specificities that have to be taken into account, as for example, access to medications, access to lab tests and so on. So there are some subtle differences between each country. And so the main point is really to gather these guys together, these colleagues together. So we can work on a document at the end, which is very similar from one country to another, because evidence is around. We all can read the same paper, the same study, the same way, whether you grade that using this system or another one. At the end, the most important is really the discussion that you can have with all these colleagues, and to thereafter try to have a consensus as to what is the best standard of care in a specific country, taking into account the healthcare system specificities. And so you know that if you are treated in Toronto, or if you are treated in Vancouver, or if you are treated in Chicoutimi, you're going to get the same type of care, follow the recommendation on which all these physicians and colleagues have agreed upon. So I think that's the most important. That's this collegial, that's this interaction, and this harmonization on how we think things that this disease should be treated that is important. At the end, so as I said, the documents are grossly the same. There are some very subtle nuances that I would say only experts can really detect into, for this medication, for example, the ACR guidelines say, it can be considered as first line, whereas the Canadian guidelines may say, well, it's the evidence to use it as first line is not that clear. And so we are a little bit more cautious, but it's very subtleties that you need to be, again, an expert to identify. But as you mentioned, it's clear that things are evolving and changing at a fast pace now. For EGPA, for example, 5 years ago, we didn't have these medications, anti-IL-5, monoclonal antibodies. So there have been a lot of revolutions and changes in this ANCA-associated vasculitis lately. And so when we did the first recommendation of the CANVAS for ANCA-associated vasculitis, that was in 2016, we hoped that it could wait 5 years or 6 years before we had to redo it and update it. But in fact, we couldn't wait that long. So we updated it in 2019, so only 3 years after the first edition, because yes, there have been new data on plasma exchange with the PEXIVAS trial. There have been new data on rituximab as being what we wrote in the Canadian guideline, nowadays the first line treatment for maintenance in GPA and EGPA, which we couldn't write in 2016. It was still too early. And since then, there have been more data showing that it's really the gold standard for maintenance now. And of course, there was no study on mepolizumab at the time, so now there are some for EGPA. And I don't know when we're going to do the next update, but you know that there are some new medications that are now available or will become very soon available for ANCA-associated vasculitis, complement inhibitors, for example. And that seems these are medications that may again change importantly the way we manage this condition. And so maybe in 3 years from now, we'll need again an update on this disease. I would say 20 years ago, things were easier. We had studies, it took 5 to 10 years before having a big switch, a big change. Now it goes way faster, and that's very great. It really illustrates how the research has gone to a faster pace. Also, how much industry, pharmaceutical companies are more and more interested in these rare conditions. Before that, you know, when you discuss ideal, I'm an expert in rare conditions, people look at you like, okay, man, but let's put the investment in diabetes or coronary artery disease where there is way more patients. But now there has been a shift in the landscape, in the way all these diseases are seen and considered. And it's very great to see it goes that fast. But we have to follow the pace. We have to be ready. And that's why you have all this CANVAS network, the VCRC network. So we are ready. We are kind of, I see us as a kind of a platform where we are ready for any change. And so rapid and prompt to act and to adjust the recommendation, adjust our educational material. We also have at CANVAS educational book that is called Cavalli, and it's available free of charge online. You just have to contact CANVAS and we can send you a copy of that. And same thing, we update that also every 3 years now, because there are so many things to update every 3 years. That's incredible.
Really is incredible, especially being able to update it that frequently. It kind of shows, you know, like you were saying, how fast-paced this field is really moving. Even from my diagnosis, 6 years ago to now, you know, things have completely changed. I am really interested. You were mentioning a little bit of the differences between the ACR guidelines and the CANVAS guidelines, and basically how you're making determinations for recommendations about maintenance treatment versus, you know, induction and all of that. How are those decisions made in Canada? Is it purely data-based, just seeing, you know, what has succeeded for patients? Because I know in the United States, there's always the, you know, the insurance question, is it going to get covered and how do we do that? Yeah. So how does that work, I guess, from a Canadian perspective?
No, you mentioned exactly the point. We always have to consider what is the real life. It's great to say, oh, let's say this new anti-IL-5 monoclonal antibody at that dose is the gold standard. But thereafter, if you know that in none of the Canadian province, you can get access to that drug, it's not covered. What is the point to write something that is not not realistic? We want to write something to suggest that, because then we can go to the payers, to the government, to the federal agencies, to the provincial agencies, saying, hey, we CANVAS say that's the best treatment. So you have to allow and you have to cover for this drug as of now. So to try to push that. But it's always the balance between we want to push things and we know what is real life. And so that's an adjustment. And that's why we need to have this group of writers of when you develop recommendations. And as I mentioned before, it's different in the US than it is in Canada or any other country. There are some limitations that have to be taken into account when we write that. So you mentioned the diagnosis aspect. Let's discuss about the first recommendation of the CANVAS that is about ANCA testing. You know what is the ANCA, the antibody that is kind of the hallmark of some of these ANCA-associated vasculitides, PR3 ANCA, MPO ANCA for GPA, or microscopic polyangiitis. In 2016, we wrote that they can be tested by either ELISA or immunofluorescence. And we wrote that because lots of my colleagues in Canada said, well, you know, in my center here, there's no way I can get access to ELISA. So you have to write that it can be immunofluorescence. You can write that ELISA might be the best, but if it's not possible, what do you do? And in this new updated version, because there have been studies and international studies showing that the gold standard nowadays is ELISA, we wrote clearly in these updates, the gold standard is ELISA. We don't do immunofluorescence anymore. And it came gradually, but all these colleagues who could not have access to ELISA in 2016, they gradually got access to that. I don't know if our CANVAS recommendation helped for the lab to get access to ELISA, but I hope it did a little bit, or it pushed the change. And nowadays we can write clearly ELISA test for ANCA is the gold standard. That's the number one. So it's really taking into consideration all of that, the real life, what is in the study, what are the international consensus from other groups, and merging all of that in a document that is applicable and that is realistic, that makes sense to the patients in one specific country.
Right. I would wonder too, kind of tying it into a lot of the younger researchers that I'm sure you work with. It's kind of the newer generation of people getting into vasculitis and studying it as a whole. We've had a couple of younger researchers on our podcast in the past. How much of that sort of overall theme do you really try and stress to them? This concept of not just looking at this from a numbers perspective and kind of, you know, because it's sort of something that I know applies to a lot of other things, especially now where with the availability of data being so much higher than it was certainly when you started studying this back in the late 90s, early 2000s. How much of that should be stressed when you're thinking about this from the research perspective of going forward? And do you see people understanding when as they go into this that it's sort of that natural thing you have to prevent yourself from gravitating towards and just solely going off of the data you're seeing and understanding this whole patient idea that in a lot of other types of diseases is not really as prevalent as far as the, you know, the interaction you get with the patients.
Yeah, I think for the next, for the current researcher, the younger one, as you mentioned, it's true that there is more and more data. There is also more and more medications. There is a lot of research that has been ongoing for the past 10 years, and we have more and more biologics, more and more targeted therapy that comes around. And the temptation would be to just juggle with all of that and just hope that you're going to be lucky enough to say, oh, I'm going to juggle with this data and see if something statistically significant will come out. Or there are so many biologics, I'm going to pick one and test it in a cohort of patients. And if it doesn't work, I'm going to move to the other one. But that's where you need, as you mentioned, to understand the disease, understand what you're doing. So it's important for the current researcher generation to keep understanding what are these diseases and to gain their clinical experience, to understand what it is, to understand what are the unmet needs, if there are still unmet needs, and work on things to know exactly what are the questions and what is the future or what are the changes. It's not just playing with what is available without thinking. They need to understand what they're doing. I think the vasculitis research has kind of evolved in a way that I tend sometimes to compare with cancer treatment and cancer research. We know vasculitis is not a cancer, that's clear. Huh? But we use the same vocabulary, the same wording, and we kind of used almost the same treatment approach. You know that in this disease, we always say we want to induce the remission. That's exactly the word we would say for cancer. Once the remission is achieved, we go on a maintenance treatment. That's been one of the big change in the 1990s, having a two-staged approach for this disease. And now we have treatment that works pretty well for most of our conditions, let's say GPA or MPA. 90% of our patients are in remission at some point. And 10 years later, a good 60, 70% of them are in relapse-free, sustained remission. And we are focusing more and more on long-term damage, side effects of medication. Everything that happened already with a kind of a type of cancer, like let's say lymphoma. Lymphoma in the past, where you had a combination of chemotherapy to induce remission, then a combination of chemotherapy to maintain remission, and then came new medications or different strategies, so that nowadays for some of the lymphoma, we don't use maintenance anymore. We just have an even more effective induction treatment, and that's almost a one-shot time treatment, and then you're good for 10 years. And I think it's kind of this wavy cycle life of a condition and treatment that I think we need to think of for this vasculitis now. We have very effective induction and maintenance treatment now. We need to rethink how we can make it better, how we can shorten the treatment, how we can even identify treatment that works better with less side effects. I mentioned the complement inhibitors. That's a new generation of treatment that we're going to start using for this ANCA-associated vasculitis. But maybe there are some other combination or a way to do even better. I hope you see my parallel between this approach between cancer, oncology, and the way we treat vasculitis, because I think there have been a lot of similarities here, and we need to get examples of what has been done successfully in other conditions, in other fields, to try and say, hey, can we do as well in vasculitis? In the oncology world, also genetic, molecular biology helped a lot. I individualized the treatment for each patient. And that's something we haven't done yet that well in vasculitis. But I hope that tomorrow we're going to have even more effective induction treatment individualized to each patient based on some molecular markers. And therefore, we would know, oh, here, we don't even need a maintenance treatment because we have this combination of induction treatment that works even better. And to achieve these goals, that's exactly where registries can help us to identify subsets of patients, identify response to the treatment. And of course, we still need randomized controlled trials, but we need to have in mind what are the question and understand what we're doing. As I said, it's not just here is a database, a huge database, or here is, a new biologics, why don't we try it in vasculitis? It's kind of a fishing expedition here, and I'm not opposed to the fishing expedition state of mind, but I prefer to go based on some good question, rationales for studying this or that aspect of things.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting that you bring up the parallels between oncology and vasculitis treatment, because when I was diagnosed, actually, my rheumatologist told me that it was basically the cancer of the rheumatology field when is trying to explain, you know, the sort of treatment process and all of that.
Exactly. And you know that what you receive, and sometimes patients come to me being frightened when they open the box of their medication, like, let's say cyclophosphamide, and they say it's written chemotherapy. No, nobody told me about that I would receive a chemotherapy. Huh?
I've been there.
No, I have. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Ben.
That was the first treatment I was on. I mean, I remember that. Remember that well.
Yeah. No, I have a family friend who had I forget which type of cancer, but basically he used higher doses of rituximab to treat his cancer, and I was doing, you know, rituximab treatments for induction and maintenance therapy for vasculitis. So it was just really interesting to see the similarities there.
Exactly.
Yep. And I know we don't want to take up too much of your afternoon. I feel like we could keep going for quite a while, but just in terms of talking about, you know, the registries, the fishing expeditions, what kind of research needs to still be done? Do you have one or two big questions that you really hope that researchers can really start to sink their teeth into in the next 10 or so years?
Well, I don't think there is one or two questions. There are tons of questions. I can list the different things. I mentioned some of them regarding can we do better in terms of treatment? What is the optimal duration of this or that maintenance treatment? Can we do shorter? Can we decrease the damage? Can we understand better the mechanism of the disease to help us individualize better the treatment? There are tons of things. I think beside that, I think we need to also remember that there are some understudied vasculitis. And I had a lot of passion. I still have a lot of passion for GPA, MPA, and EGPA, but CNS vasculitis needs to be better studies with larger international collaboration. Skin vasculitis is not that a severe disease, but it can be very annoying on a daily basis for our young patients to have always permanently red dots on the legs. They are not going to die of bleeding in the lungs, but their life is miserable because they have this pain in the legs and these red dots all the time. And they have not been, this disease has not been as much studied as others. So beyond doing the obvious, can we do better in terms of treatment? We need to focus on some diseases that have been understudied. I think also we need to develop more collaboration, because we worked a lot as a silo. There were rheumatology-based research. There was nephrology-based research. There is neurology-based research. And even in the clinic, several of us have developed what we call the combined clinic, so that we all sit together in the same room. Me as a rheumatologist and the neurologist and or the nephrologist, and we see patients together, and the patients love that first, because they don't have to go on Monday see one and then on Tuesday see the other one who doesn't know what the first one has said. So we really share right away the clinical expertise, the clinical suggestions, but also it's raised a lot of interesting question for study, the question that on my own, I could not frame, because I didn't have that enough knowledge, or I didn't see that aspect. So I think also developing collaborations with subspecialties so we can do things together may also help us enhance the quality of the research that we are doing each other. And that's also was one of the aim of the VCRC, clearly, and the Canvas network, is to develop this collaboration to raise new and interesting question to really improve the knowledge and the treatment management of this condition. I would almost want to end up here by saying, you know, that there are some vasculitis that are disappearing. You know that hepatitis B associated polyarteritis nodosa has disappeared almost since the development of the HPV vaccine. You know that there is one that is disappearing now, that is the hepatitis C associated cryovascularis, because now we have antiviral, anti-hepatitis C medication that works very well. So we see some vasculitis disappear. It's possible. We need to know better the mechanism. We need to know if there is what is the cause of the disease when there is one, and there is hope that some medication can really cure the condition as opposed to achieve a sustained remission. But for that, there's still some work to do, but there are some good example that it is possible.
That is the ultimate goal, right? Not just the sustainment, of course. I think it is a great way to end on as well. And that's, I think, a big reason why I talk about the VCRC, CanVasc, all of these amazing things you've been a part of, Dr. Panyu. And we obviously hope that those developments will continue to be really fruitful for you and your team here in the years to come. It's been such a pleasure talking with you, getting to learn more about what you were doing and some of the new research as well. And hopefully you aren't having to, hopefully it's not like every year you're having to completely rewrite your guidelines. It seems like the timeline gets shorter and shorter every time. But we appreciate you spending some time with us and wish you all the best here going forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Kaylee. Thank you, Ben.
And thanks again to Dr. Christian Panyu for joining us on Season 2 of Vasculitis Visionaries. A lot of good stuff. Kaylee, as always, we want to thank our sponsors as well for making this podcast possible in GSK and Genentech. Certainly can't wait until the borders are back open. I can visit one of the great cities in North America again, Toronto. But in the meantime, great to at least have Dr. Panyu take us inside his world and all the cool research that he's doing.
Very much so. Also, I'm interested to hear more about why you think Toronto is the greatest city. We'll have to get to that some other time.
It is, okay. All I'm going to say is beaver tails. It's not, and if you've never heard of that, you are in for, it is maybe the greatest dessert item ever invented. And I will leave it at that. You're going to have to Google it.
Health is what we care about on this podcast. So we want to encourage everyone to take advantage of that.
It's a lot of fried dough. That's all I will say. My great trip to Toronto a few years ago. All right. Well, we are going to have a fantastic episode coming up for you in May, talking with Dr. Leonard Calabresi. So stay tuned for that. Again, you can catch all of our archived episodes available on our Spotify and Apple podcast channels as well. If you missed any of our Season 1 episodes, or if you want to check out some of our earlier episodes from Season 2. All right, Kaylee, have a good one. We will talk again soon. And thanks again for hanging out with me today.
Thanks so much, Ben.